This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, the actions of the crew of the ill-fated flight PX73 and Air New Guinea's training procedures to be put under the spotlight as investigations continue.
At the end of the day, not this week, but months from now, the airline will be in the spotlight for the investigators and their practices and procedures.
And an ambitious plan by Timor-Leste to build an oil and gas pipeline, but would it leave the country in a dire financial situation if it all collapses? That story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beat. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First though, Papua New Guinea health authorities have confirmed the first polio-related death since the disease re-emerged earlier this year. They say a 9-year-old boy who was so badly paralysed has died because he could no longer breathe, as Yara Murray-Atfield reports.
It's a situation that Papua New Guinea hasn't had to deal with since before the turn of the century.
The 9-year-old child that had been infected with polio in Nenga province has died.
The child, a boy, was one of the 14 confirmed polio cases in PNG's renewed outbreak so far. Dr. Sibak Biab is the Executive Manager of Public Health and the National Coordinator for the Polio Response.
The child was not being treated in any hospital because the paralysis that was in this child. He had been seen in hospital, but there was nothing else that the hospital or the facility where he was could do for him, so he was actually sent home. And he died as a result of the paralysis involving his muscles of breathing.
PNG was declared officially polio-free in 2000, and before June this year, the last recorded case was in 1996. Dr. Robert Hall is former chair of the Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation for the World Health Organization's Western Pacific region.
It's a major tragedy for the child and for the family, and this is an illustration of why we're trying to completely eradicate polio from the face of the earth to avoid this kind of tragedy from happening again.
After the death in Enga, the WHO and the PNG Health Department say there are now 13 cases confirmed across 6 provinces.
Deaths are not that unusual with polio. Polio is a very serious disease. What's different about this case is that it's a case from circulating vaccine-derived polio, which is one of the problems that can occur if immunisation coverage is not high.
The WHO says circulating vaccine-derived polio generally occurs when the strain has been allowed to grow in an under-immunised population for more than a year. Children infected with the polio present with acute flaccid paralysis, which often includes weakness in the arms and legs and in the muscles used for breathing and swallowing. Dr. Biab says paralysis has been recorded in 140 children so far, some of whom are under the age of 5.
When the first case of polio was diagnosed, we had a total of 8 cases of acute flaccid paralysis nationwide. As I speak, the number of acute flaccid paralysis cases that have been detected nationwide is now standing at 140. That doesn't mean that every one of those 140 cases will be due to polio, because there are other conditions, of course, that can give you the same paralysis.
PNG health officials have sent stool samples from all 140 of the suspected polio patients to the Victorian Infectious Diseases Reference Laboratory, where tests will confirm or rule out the presence of the disease. And for any who are found to have contracted polio, the prognosis is bleak.
There's no cure for polio, and anybody that becomes paralysed with polio are paralysed for life, really. And any help that we can give to them is mainly rehabilitative rather than curative. So the 13 confirmed cases who have paralysis now, their treatment can only be, you know, rehabilitative, palliative, but not curative.
The news of the death in Enga came as a nationwide campaign to vaccinate all children under the age of 15 against the polio virus was beginning. The PNG Health Department says that means immunising more than 3 million children. But Dr. Hall says it's the right strategy.
In other parts of the world, techniques like this have been very successful in stamping out the circulating vaccine-derived polioviruses. So it's very important for Papua New Guinea that they conduct a high-quality round or maybe several rounds of immunisation using the vaccine.
But there's a real need to act fast. Health officials say the boy who died in Enger was from a settlement where people live in very close proximity and sanitation is extremely poor. The sole case confirmed in the capital, Port Moresby, so far was of a six-year-old who also lives in a settlement. And there are real fears that it's in those communities where the greatest risk lies of the current polio outbreak escalating into an epidemic.
Ciara Murray-Atfield reporting there. Well, questions about the actions of the crew of the ill-fated Air New Guinea flight PX73 and the training they've received will make up part of the investigations trying to determine what happened when the plane landed short of the runway as it came into land in the Federated States of Micronesia last week. PNG Media reports that the black box flight recorder has been retrieved by divers yesterday, and they're going to continue again today to recover the cockpit voice recorder to help with investigations. It's been confirmed that one passenger did die. The body of an Indonesian man was recovered by divers conducting a further search on Monday. The Indonesian embassy in Tokyo, which is also responsible for FSM, has confirmed to the ABC that the man was 23-year-old Singing, who'd worked for a ship in the area. The remaining 46 passengers and crew, though, were evacuated safely. Now, as investigations continue, some accounts of what happened have emerged from passengers. Here's how the editor of the local newspaper in FSM, Bill James, who was on board, recounted it.
We came in low. We came in very low. Unfortunately, the flight attendants panicked and started yelling. And I was trying to be calm and help as best I could.
Well, the pilot and a former aviation journalist, Georgie Petto, says that the actions of the crew, as well as the practices and procedures, will all make up part of the accident investigation.
There will be numerous things they will have to look at. First of all, they will have to look at the airline's training procedure. It's no secret that depending on which part of the world you fly in as a passenger, safety and safety consciousness of the airlines will be different and they will vary greatly. Again, no secret, European big airliners are the ones who commit the most energy, effort and money into training. Training is really the name of the game here. If the crew is not trained properly, then, of course, their instincts will kick in and they will panic. Now, that's not to say that very well-trained flight attendants will not be afraid when the unexpected happens, because it's one thing to train an event and it's another thing to be in it. And, of course, there's no way to simulate the psychological stress that might occur when an event like this will happen. But nevertheless, as it was the case with the sort of the miracle on the Hudson event, the flight attendants there apparently were very professional and they evacuated the plane in an extremely orderly manner. Now, you know, again, it will be a long process to determine what the flight attendants did and did not do. And at the end of the day, not this week, but months from now, the airline will be in the spotlight for the investigators and their practices and procedures.
It's Georgie Petto, who's a pilot and a former aviation journalist.
Pacific Beat.
Timor-Leste is pressing ahead with an ambitious plan to build a pipeline carrying oil and gas from the Greater Sunrise Reserves all the way to its south coast in the hope that it would transform the country, bringing wealth, skilled jobs and development to what is a fledgling nation. But Dili has been struggling to convince the energy companies which own the rights to the lucrative gas field to sign up to its vision. They want to send the gas instead to Australia. Our Pacific Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts explains.
Timor-Leste is a small country with big ambitions. It wants to pipe the oil and gas from the vast Greater Sunrise fields all the way to a small village on its south coast. That's not all. Timor envisions vast new infrastructure springing up to process and export the raw materials, an LNG plant, a refinery, even a new airport, all connected by a smooth new highway. Dr. Beck Strating from La Trobe University says that plan is central to the economic vision of the nation's elite.
Timorese leaders have really staked the economic future of the state in onshore oil processing. Leaders have been looking towards oil industrialisation as being the key plank in Timor-Leste's economic future.
The main problem is that the four companies which own the rights to Greater Sunrise are not convinced the plan will work. The pipeline would have to cross an undersea trench which plunges to depths of 3 kilometres, and companies question whether Timor-Leste has the skills and experience to build a new industry from scratch. But Timor is not for turning, and now it's raising the stakes, purchasing 30% of Greater Sunrise from the US energy giant ConocoPhillips at a cost of almost $500 million. Conoco wanted to pump the oil and gas to Darwin instead, but one of its vice presidents, Kayleen Ewan, has told the ABC it was an amicable parting of ways.
But it really was just a full and frank exchange of information where we both could assess, or we could all assess, what the options were and the implications for each other. For us, a Timor-Leste-based option doesn't compete in our portfolio, but we respect the fact that Timor does have different drivers and is really interested in that economic development of their south coast.
By buying out Conoco, Timor-Leste amplifies its voice in negotiations and removes a significant opponent to its plan. But there's still no sign that the other companies will be willing to bend to its will. Earlier this year, the UN estimated that the Timor government's plan for a pipeline and a domestic industry would only stand up if it received a subsidy of almost $8 billion. Carly Munnelly, who's a researcher at the Timorese NGO Lau Hamatuk, says the government still hasn't presented any comprehensive evidence that the mega project stacks up.
We've yet to see a public cost-benefit risk analysis. Any public documents that we've seen, any analysis that we've seen, has concluded questioning, I suppose, the project's economic viability.
She's also worried it could devastate the local environment and displace large numbers of locals.
I think the Tasimani project is a implication of the resource curse, which Timor-Leste has fallen victim to. And what that's meant is that there's been this lack of long-term planning and this obsession with the oil industry as the only way to sustain state revenues.
Whatever its merits, that obsession isn't abating. And Dili's decision to purchase a stake shows it's willing to back that vision with cold, hard cash. It's courting overseas finance to find new sources of capital for the project. But if that doesn't happen, then Timor will have to funnel billions of dollars from its own sovereign wealth fund into the project. And time is running out. That sovereign wealth fund is dwindling, and the gas and oil fields which supply its wealth will run dry within 5 years. Dr. Beck Strating from La Trobe University says Timor-Leste has taken an enormous risk by putting all of its eggs in one basket.
There doesn't seem to be any other plan for Timor-Leste's future. So, you know, if the pipeline falls through, what else would there be in order to try to develop Timor-Leste's economy in the mid to long term?
And if Timor-Leste does fall off a fiscal cliff, then it might well be up to Australia to pick up the pieces.
That's Stephen Jedgett's reporting there. Well, New Caledonia's independence referendum might just be a month away, but there's still controversy over who exactly is registered in the official electoral rolls. The United Nations recently confirmed that voter registration has taken place in a fair and transparent way, although it did identify some discrepancies. Pro-independence campaigners, though, contend that those possible errors may mean that thousands of Indigenous Kanaks will be unable to vote in the referendum on November the 4th. Priyanka Srinivasan has this report from the capital, Noumea.
With time closing in, pro-independence campaigner Madeline Ohu is helping Indigenous Kanak voters check to see if their names have made it onto the special electoral list.
Mais comme tu vas pas aller voter là-bas, eh bien, voilà, tu peux pas.
Madeline has found that some Indigenous Kanaks who, according to her records, should be automatically included, are not actually registered. She believes they've been left out because the registration system relied on government employment and health records that don't always reflect Indigenous ways of living.
Since we are getting closer to the referendum, we are here today to help all those who want to come and check that they are indeed on the referendum electoral roll. The reason we can't find them is that the social protection records called CAFAT that we use to cross-reference the lists don't take into account many Kanaks because they are not in the economic system. Those who are not declared as workers but work a lot at home in their tribes, they are often left out when we compare lists.
Official records show that just over 174,000 people are registered to vote in the November referendum, and about 46% of those are Indigenous Kanaks. The Pro-Independence Alliance, FLNKS, estimates that some 3,000 Kanaks are missing from official voting registries, which they argue could have a significant impact on the final result. Some groups are taking drastic measures to contend these lists. New Caledonia's Pro-Independence Workers' Party, known as USTKE, plans to abstain from voting, arguing the French government failed to adequately stop electoral fraud and that it didn't do enough to engage Kanak voters. But French anti-independence loyalists have also taken issue with electoral rolls. They've criticized the stringent criteria citizens have been forced to meet in order to be allowed to vote. But they successfully lobbied to have all New Caledonian people born in the territory, with some exceptions, eligible to vote in the referendum, no matter their ethnicity or status as Indigenous Kanaks. So why all this controversy over a simple electoral list? The reason is partly historic. In 1984, a pro-independence militant, Eli Moshoru, publicly destroyed a ballot box in protest of an electoral system which he believed privileged non-Kanaks. 3 years later, Kanaks largely boycotted New Caledonia's first independence referendum for similar reasons. That meant that when officials negotiated the Matignon and Noumier Accords, the roadmaps leading to this year's referendum, they included strict qualifications in an attempt to ensure that only those with a deep connection to the country would be able to vote. Thierry Letaste is the French High Commissioner in New Caledonia and is overseeing the referendum and voter registration process.
For the referendum in New Caledonia, France has done something it has never done before, and aim to register all eligible people as voters in the referendum, even those who have not personally registered. So we had to draw up a list of all the people who have been living in New Caledonia for more than 6 months, and after that, these people would automatically be registered on the electoral list. This gives practically everybody a chance to be registered.
As for the accusations that some Kanaks have been left off the electoral list, the High Commissioner believes this is unfounded and based on a misreading of official records that have erroneously overstated the number of Kanaks in New Caledonia. The UN also concluded in its recent review that it had found no evidence of electoral fraud and believed the referendum will be carried out in a fair and transparent manner. It did find some discrepancies in cases where people were registered without the correct documents and recommended an audit, which the High Commissioner has agreed to carry out. But it's unlikely that the audit will be complete in time for the referendum on the 4th of November. Nevertheless, voters have the chance to register for the referendum right until the day of the vote, and UN experts, along with an independent team of observers from France, will be overseeing polls to ensure no eligible voters are turned away.
That's Priyanka Srinivasan reporting there from Noumea in New Caledonia. Well, while doubts remain over the future of Australia's Pacific Island Workers Program, the former minister who devised New Zealand's farm worker scheme says there could be room for further expansion. Trevor Mallard, who's now the Speaker in the New Zealand Parliament, is currently leading a cross-party delegation to Vanuatu and Solomon Islands at a time when New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has just committed an additional $300 million for climate change mitigation. It's a strategy which Mr. Mallard has hinted may not be entirely removed from concerns over China's growing Pacific interests. And he says Wellington is keen to strengthen its relations with the island countries. He spoke with Richard Hewitt from Vanuatu.
We are very interested in our regional employment scheme. We have a lot of workers coming down on a scheme that's been going for about a decade, which has people working in areas of labour shortage for a period of time and then coming back home. I think there are about 3,000 people from Vanuatu come down under that scheme to New Zealand. We wanted to see how it was working from their perspective. We're interested in New Zealand aid. There's quite a few small-scale projects, both in Vanuatu and the Solomons. We wanted to get some first-hand views on how they're working. And then obviously climate change is a very big issue. one which there's a lot of government focus on as well.
To go back to the question of the employment scheme, I mean, clearly the New Zealand scheme, I think, as there's no question, has been a lot more successful historically than the Australian scheme. And there is now a question mark hanging over the Australian Pacific Workers program with attempts to bring in a new agricultural visa in Australia. So, I mean, could this be an opportunity for New Zealand to build on what you already have and grow an even bigger scheme?
I'm going to be slightly modest here and say that it was very well designed by the Minister of Labour at the time in New Zealand. I was that minister. We did consult widely with the Pacific and had the advantage at the time of a Prime Minister with a very clear vision as to how she wanted to help build communities in the Pacific, as well as solve labour shortages short term in New Zealand. I think that there's room for a few more workers in New Zealand, but what's always been important to us is that we don't want our wages and conditions within New Zealand undercut, and we want to make sure that people are well looked after in terms of housing and pastoral care when they're there. And earlier in our scheme, we did have a few hiccups. You know, there were some employers who took advantage of people totally inappropriately. There was some accommodation which, frankly, wasn't up to scratch. But over time, I think we've worked through all of those issues. And the scheme actually now creates a lot of jobs for New Zealanders, especially in the downstream part of the horticulture industry.
On the question of climate change, the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has announced $300 million New Zealand dollars will be spent on climate funding for the Pacific. And that's a pretty large sum of money. I mean, is there any feeling here, as there seems to be in Australia, that New Zealand needs to spend big in case China gets there first?
Because it's a parliamentary mission and I'm not part of the government and I want to be very careful in diplomatic areas, I have no doubt that we can do better in the Pacific than we have been. I mean, I think our contacts with the Pacific are quite good. We see a lot of our Pacific neighbours, the parliamentarians in New Zealand. We probably don't spend as much time in the islands as we should. But I think the relationship is generally a very positive one, one which comes from multiple contacts over a period of time. And it is important to New Zealand to retain that relationship and not to be edged out.
That's Trevor Mallard. He's the Speaker of the New Zealand Parliament. He was on the line there from Vanuatu speaking with Richard Hewitt. The alarm bells ringing again about the state of soccer in Papua New Guinea after a recent scheduled presidential congress was called off, apparently because the PNGFA could not afford the cost of staging the event. A new date has been set for the end of this month, but it means a further delay in electing a new FA president and also in the signing of an MOU that was drafted by FIFA and designed to reunite the rival factions in PNG, which have been at odds with each other for nearly 2 years. The disruptions cast serious doubt over whether the Danish coach, Flemming Seretslev, is continuing his work with the national team. And the captain of that team, the Couples, Raymond Gunemba, says he and his teammates are seriously concerned that PNG is being left behind by their rival Pacific nations like Fiji, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands.
They need to sort out the president, because right now our National Soccer League, we haven't had the exact time it's going to take place and the preparation for the national team too. So it's really important for the meeting to be held and appoint the new president. So everything should get underway. The preparation for the national team, the senior men's, the women's and the competition, then NSL. It's really important. I'm really concerned about this. They should sort these things out, even the financial problem too. They need to sort themselves out for the good of football in the country.
So whilst you've been over in Australia playing with Geelong and very successfully too, the team have won promotion, I imagine you would have been aware that Fiji have played games, Vanuatu have played games, Solomon Islands have played games, Papua New Guinea hasn't played an international for over a year now. I mean, that's a real worry, isn't it?
Yes, that's one of the real important things, because while I was in Australia, I had all the countries traveling out for the international friendlies, but we Papua New Guinea, we didn't have any. It's really bad for the team in the country. We need to have international friendly and we need to get our team organized so we can know if the coach is coming back or we'll have one of the Papua New Guinea coach or we have a new coach from the overseas. We don't know anything at all.
So as far as the coach is concerned, you don't know whether Fleming Saretslev, who achieved a lot with the team, is still the coach or not. I mean, he's not in Papua New Guinea at the moment, is he?
No, right now Fleming is not in Papua New Guinea. I believe he's back home. But he have achieved a lot in the national team, like big improvement, big achievement for the country, and he should be back.
The fact, though, that FIFA have intervened in this situation, I mean, does that give you some cause for hope that there is a solution close now after, what, 18 months of disruption in the country?
Yeah, it's good that FIFA has intervened. The breakaway of the two FA has caused a big downfall in the soccer in the country. So it's good that the FIFA has intervened. So we're going to reunite, and I think we'll start from there and we try to build up a good reputation for the FA in the country.
That is Raymond Gnemba. He's the captain of PNG's national soccer team, the Carpels, and he was speaking there with Richard Hewitt. And that is all for Pacific Beat this morning. But don't forget, we're on air in the afternoons as well. That's from 3 p.m. PNG, 5 o'clock if you're in Fiji, for example. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks very much for your company. You have a great day.